Thanks for tuning in to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thirst for More podcast was created to help strength and conditioning coaches, personal trainers, fitness enthusiasts, and anyone that loves lifting heavy shit all be connected under one roof. We take deep dives into coaching, programming and training, running gyms, nutrition, and overall improving your knowledge in the field of strength and conditioning. If you're new here, I'm glad you're able to tune in and hope you can just take away one awesome piece of information today to help you along with your journey. If you're a returning supporter, I appreciate you being along for the ride. Now let's dive into today's episode. Welcome back to another episode of the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. And today we're going to talk about a subject I guarantee that a lot of people get wrong. There's a lot of misconceptions about this, and that is going to be training older adults. And before you start to think that this episode is going to be talking about necessarily doing like chair exercises, like sit to stand, just using resistance bands, I'm going to stop you right there, because the approach that most trainers take with older clients is not just necessarily overly cautious, but I believe that it's actually doing them a disservice. So I'm going to talk today about why the standard of quote-unquote senior fitness models is pretty much fundamentally flawed at this point in 2026. And what the research actually can tell us about training aging populations and how you can get significantly better results with your older clients while still keeping them safe. Now, here's what makes this topic so critical from a business perspective or as a personal trainer is that the demographics are pretty undeniable at this point. And it's estimated that by 2030, all baby boomers will be over the age of 65, and this represents the largest and often the most financially stable client base that you're going to have access to if you are a personal trainer. Now, here's the problem is that most trainers are either so scared of the liability risk and so indoctrinated with the idea that the older adults are fragile and that they can't prescribe them high quality training programs, and what they can do seems boring and useless. Or not just that they're scared, that they're uneducated about how to go training this population. So they might think that they're going to do light weights, very high repetitions, variety of weird kind of balance exercises that don't really actually improve their balance. Or they could just even completely avoid anything that looks even remotely challenging and like training. And the research says something completely different here. So older adults can and should train with a significant amount of intensity. Now, that's obviously going to be relative, right? We're not necessarily going to take a 70-year-old person and put them underneath a 500-pound barbell, but we can find something that's challenging for that individual, and everybody's going to be a different place in their journey based upon their health history and their training experience that they've had before, if they've had any at all, right? So, I mean, intensity is relative for this population. Somebody like you or me might think that that's not necessarily intense, but it could be intense for them. But it's also important that this population still can build some muscle. They can improve their strength. They can improve their power output. And when we fail to actually provide adequate stimulus, we're not protecting them. We're actually probably accelerating their decline by babying them, okay? Just because they're old does not mean that they're babies. They are still adults. They can still train. We can still get progress with this population. And so today in this episode, I'm going to be talking about everything that you can do for working with this population and hopefully help give you some ideas of how you can approach this population, not only backed by research, but also firsthand experience of me working with adults. I believe the oldest person that I have trained was in their low 80s whenever I stopped working with them. Whenever I opened my gym, they, I believe, were like 80 or 81. They're still training to this day on their own from things that I do with them. They're just choosing to stay at the rec center because it's kind of paid for them, so I understand. I wish I was still training her. She's an amazing woman. But we still have a couple people in their 70s and even in their 60s that I still work with to this day at Thirst. And people think of us as a sports performance facility. And while that is a large amount of our client base, we still train our older athletes to a high degree and actually give them some high quality training. So I'm going to obviously give you some firsthand experience when it comes to that as well. We're also going to kind of talk about some of the physiological changes that are going to be important and the training variables that you might need to adjust, which ones you probably don't need to bother with adjusting, and then also common injuries and how to work around them intelligently with this population. And even some of the business side of working with these older adults that most people just don't talk about. So let's get right into this here. And before I think that we can really talk about training adaptations, we need to understand what's actually happening from a physiological perspective as people age just in general. Even you and me, we are aging every single day, right? I know the way that I have to train now and definitely the way that my body feels now is vastly different from 10 years ago when I was competing in powerlifting. My training even looks different. So things are just going to happen as part of the natural aging process, and we have to accept that. And if I can go back 10 years ago to the 27-year-old me, I wish I would have had this information to know what was coming. I know people were trying to tell me, and I kind of brushed it off, and I really wish I would not have done that. So let's talk about some of the physiological things here. And aging is not a disease. You know, it's just a natural process that happens with all living things. And while certain changes are inevitable, the rate and extent of some of those changes can be dramatically influenced by our training. And so the first major change that we see in older populations is sarcopenia, which is the age-related loss of muscle mass on the body. And so some research from the Journal of Applied Physiology shows that untrained individuals lose approximately 3-8% of muscle mass per decade after the age of 30. And this rate accelerates after the age of 60. So even when you get to your 30s, you know, you think about when you're 20s and training is great. I mean, most of the time when you're 20s, training is fantastic. Like, it's hard to train bad when you're 20. You really just need to train freaking hard, eat some protein, get some sleep, and take care of your body. And you can make tremendous progress. But I will say that once you get to that like 30 range, it does really start to feel a little bit different in terms of how your body feels having gone through that. Now, obviously, I'm not 40, so I can't speak to that point yet, but I'm sure in a couple of years I'll be able to speak on that front. So just know that you are expected to lose some muscle mass if you are an untrained person. Now, I know most of the people are listening are trained individuals, but we have to think if we're getting clientele, they very well could, and more than likely, could be in that untrained population. Right. So here's the critical point that most trainers miss is that sarcopenia is not inevitable with proper training stimulus. So studies have demonstrated that the resistance training can not only slow this loss, but actually reverse it. And with older adults showing similar relative strength gains to some younger populations. Now, the second change is a reduction in the type 2 muscle fibers, or our fast switch fibers responsible for our power and rapid force production. This is primarily why we see decreased power output and slower movement speeds in older adults, just in general. You know, as you get older, you look at the peak athleticism of the elite athletes. Mother Nature and time in general is undefeated when it comes to making athletes retire and stop. They just cannot keep up because you're constantly bringing in the young bucks that do have this power potential. So seeing that decrease is going to happen. It is inevitable from that perspective as you begin to age. And a study in the Journal of Gerontology found that two fiber cross-sectional area degrees more rapidly than one fiber with aging. So this has a massive implication from a training perspective. So if we only prescribe slow, controlled movements, we're not addressing one of the primary deficits that ends up leading to falls and overall functional decline of the older populations. Number three is that we see changes in connective tissue at this age, at this older populations. So tendons become less elastic, which can also obviously impact that performance and power output, which can also affect the force transmission as well, and the increased injury rate or risk if training is progressed too aggressively too quickly for some of these populations. Now, however, the research in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Science in Sports has shown that progressive loading can improve tendon properties even in older adults. The key is the progression strategy, not avoiding the load entirely. All right, number four is that there are neuromuscular changes going on. So older adults show decreased motor unit recruitment and slower nerve conduction velocity, and this is going to affect things like their coordination, their reaction time, their ability to generate force very quickly. But again, specific training can improve these qualities. So higher velocity-based training has been shown to improve rate of force development in older populations. It's even obviously going to work in younger populations, but it's still showing that higher velocity-based training still can improve rate of force development in these older populations. Now, where things get pretty fascinating is that, you know, most people and certifications, education, and even just general wisdom that has always been around the older population stigma is that many of these changes are not primarily caused by aging itself, but by decades of inactivity. Okay. When we think of older populations, there's usually be a point in some of these people's lives where being active, being outside, doing physical things, playing sports with their kids kind of just almost comes to like a dead halt stop, right? And that's one of the worst things that people can just do in general is just stop being physically active. Finding something, your training can change over time and how you choose to enjoy physical activity can change over time, but still being physically active to some degree is always going to be better than just waking up in the morning, going to work, coming home, sitting on the couch, or just taking your kids places. Okay. And that's generally what happens for the average adult because they start to focus on their kids and their family first. And as a new father, I understand that I want to do all these things with my son, but I also think about my training now as one, I just love training. I love being in the gym. I wish I could train every single day and recover from it and still train the way I used to when I was in my 20s. I still have that itch. But I know that one, training like that is not conducive to the way my body feels because of the things that I've done in the past. But also, too, that my training now serves a purpose of, can I stay healthy, relatively pain-free, continue to try to improve some of my movement capabilities, chase a pump, maybe build some muscle, keep my strength at a relatively high level. And then the end goal is to be able to do all the active things with my wife and my son in the future. That's ultimately what my goal is with training now at age 37. Maybe I'll jump in a powerlifting meet here and there, you know, every couple of years or so, just go to a bench only meet, just something for fun and get some competitive itch. But, you know, my training overall has changed because I've looked at what my outcome is, but notice that I'm not stopping, right? I'm just pivoting things for what I believe is now important for my goals. And so people that used to be inactive, we got to figure out a way to try to keep those people active as well. So if you happen to be getting somebody on that cuff new to parenthood, make sure you're communicating how important going to the gym or continuing to train or how training can evolve. And it doesn't have to always look the same because we just want to go after what those goals are. Now, when the researchers compare master-based athletes to sedentary older adults, the differences are crazy. So a study in the European Journal of Applied Physiology found that master-based athletes, so, you know, older athletes that were still competitive and doing the things basically all through their lives, in their 70s had muscle mass and strength compared to sedentary individuals that were in their 30s. So think about it now. If you're somebody that's in your 30s and you're still training and you're still being active, the way that you feel now, it's possible to still feel that way later into your 60s and your 70s. Now, this brings us to a pretty big distinction here is that chronological age and biological age are not the same thing. Yes, the calendar is going to turn over every single year on that birthday. And I jokingly have told some people in the gym, the worst thing now to me about training is that, you know, I'm not getting any younger and training is never going to feel as good as it does today. It's, you know, it's can always still feel good, but every day behind me was a day that training probably was going to feel better than it's going to in the future. That's just inevitable, again, to part of this aging process. But understanding that I can keep my biological age relatively low by continuing to train. And so we want to be able to do that with these older populations as we begin to work with them. But we also reverse things if we can, you know, get to work with them hopefully sooner rather than later. So your 7-year-old client that's been active their entire life is not the same, and especially from a training perspective, as the 70-year-old who has been sedentary for 40 years and comes to you to be able to shake off some of the rest. Let's just call it that. Your programming needs to reflect the training age and their current capacity, not just the number that's on their driver's license or that you're putting into your point of sale system or your assessment sheet or however you're gathering some of their health history information. Now, number two, big things here. Let's debunk some of these myths that are around the sedentary older populations here. Now, the big elephant in the room in the fitness industry is that it has created a completely separate category called senior fitness, and that it's based more on a liability concern and outdated assumptions rather than actually what the science is saying from a research perspective. So I'm going to challenge some of these myths here, because I believe they're preventing older adults from not only getting results, but also us as trainers being able to help aid these individuals to continue to get progress, breaking down some of these barriers and myths, and hopefully getting older adults to say, hey, like, this can be something that is actually good for me. So we should be doing it and being educated as a trainer. And if you're not a trainer listening to this, being educated in this and being able to help older populations get involved in physical activity can be a really good thing for their overall health and their quality of life. Now, myth number one is going to be that older adults should only use light weights with high repetitions. And you'll hear this about a couple other populations as well, but pretty much heavily in the older populations. And this is could be potentially one of the more damaging myths in the industry, because research published in Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise demonstrates that older adults need to train at intensities of at least 60 to 70% of their one rep max to see meaningful strength gains, and intensities of 75 to 90% to produce optimal results. Now, I don't want you to get caught up in the percentages here of 1RM, because let's be honest, you shouldn't one rep max grandma, okay? Let's not do that. But we want to use that percentage as a framework of how we're looking at the intensity of the loads and the effort that we're getting from the exercises, right? If we pick a very light weight, let's just take a 5-pound dumbbell, for example, and a senior fitness class is having them do 20 overhead dumbbell presses, you know, overhead presses with that dumbbell, that's not going to move the needle forward. Yes, it's better than nothing. I will 100% agree with that. But more than likely, we can use more load than 5 pounds, get those rep ranges to drop, and get close to training to failure, 1 to 2, maybe 3 reps in the tank early on working with some of these people, and, you know, just modify the volume of work that we're going to do with that individual, and we will be in that range, right, of the percentage of one rep max if we theoretically had to one rep max them on an exercise. So, you know, light weights with the higher repetitions might improve overall muscle endurance. There's definitely some research to suggest that, but they do almost nothing from a strength or muscle mass building perspective. And guess what? Older adults need to either maintain or improve the most upon from an independence perspective to help them prevent from falling or getting injured. They need general strength. They do not need strength endurance. Now, a study in the Journal of American Medical Association took nursing home residents with an average age of 87 and put them on a progressive resistance training program using 80% of their one rep max. Now, just again, just take the 80% range. You know, they're probably using some very gross estimates on these. And the results were pretty impressive here from what they found. They found significant increases in strength, muscle mass, and overall functional mobility. So if 87-year-old nursing home residents can handle the intensity they're trying to put these at, again, because their one rep max is not going to be what ours is, that you can bet that your 65 or 60-year-old client can certainly make improvement with proper progression in terms of their strength and conditioning-based work and what you're doing with your personal training. Now, myth number two is that older adults shouldn't train to failure or use challenging loads because of injury risk. So this kind of goes back to what we're talking about, but more so on the injury risk side. And the research also does not support this myth. So a comprehensive review in Sports Medicine found that resistance training in older adults has extremely low injury rate comparable to or lower than younger populations when programs are properly designed and progressed. The real risk is not training hard enough, which then leads to continued decline in their strength and their function in their everyday life. So I don't want to call it just going through the motions, but again, if the weights are incredibly light and they're not challenging themselves, or you're not challenging them, right, then it's not going to move that needle forward again, like we kind of talked about, and therefore they're going to continue to decline. So we need
to train relatively close to failure and put in good quality effort, as well as not just necessarily chase a percentage of what our max that we're training at, but also make sure the repetitions that we're doing, we make our clients or the older population, older individual that we happen to be discussing this with, that they understand that doing the exercises close to failure is pretty important. All right, myth number three is that balance training should focus primarily on unstable surfaces like BOSU balls. Okay, if you know me, you know my opinion on BOSU balls. Throw them in the trash, don't invest in them, pop them, do whatever you want to do. But, you know, this overall topic just in general makes me frustrated because it's very prevalent in the fitness community as a whole, not just with seniors or older individuals, but you see it in the athletic performance realm, you see it in the new personal training realm. You just walk into probably any gym in America, especially the big commercialized ones, you're going to see those freaking BOSU balls and you're going to see people doing the stupidest shit on them, okay? It's a complete waste of your training time, especially when it comes to improving the balance, which is what many people believe they're getting out of the exercise. So research in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research shows that balance training on unstable surfaces has minimal transfer to real-world balance and fall prevention. So you know what does prevent falls is that this amazing thing called leg strength, particularly in your quads, your adductors, your glutes, your hamstrings, your ability to generate force relatively rapidly. And so a study in the British Medical Journal found that strength training reduced fall risk by up to 40%, while traditional balance exercises on unstable surfaces showed negligible effects. That research study showed that there was basically no improvement for these older individuals falling by doing balance training on unstable surfaces or a BOSU ball. So just focus on some good quality strength training, some single leg work will go a long way. Myth number four is that older adults can't build muscle or gain strength like their younger counterparts. And this is also pretty much false. While the absolute magnitude might be slightly lower, right? The relative adaptations are relatively similar. So a meta-analysis in the European Journal of Sport Science found that older adults can increase muscle mass by up to 10 to 15% and strength by 25 to 35% with proper training, which represents similar percentage gains that you would see in younger individuals. Obviously not going to be quite as much. The gains are going to be slower, right? You know, you're obviously working with less load probably just in general, but progress is still doable at this age for these individuals. And the last myth that I want to address is the idea that we need to be overly cautious and conservative with our progression. So the irony is that being too cautious is actually more dangerous, because when we underdose the actual training stimulus that we're giving these people, especially if they're paying us for our expertise, we fail to create the adaptations that we actually need to protect against the injury that they could potentially see in their everyday life. So a study in age and aging found that older adults who participated in moderate to vigorous intensity training had significantly lower injury rates in daily activities compared to those who did light exercises because they had built the capacity to handle the physical demands. And so we want to make sure that, yes, you should always be trying to keep people safe in the weight room, the strength conditioning room, however you're training people, wherever you're training them at. Safety is obviously always a priority. As somebody that works with athletes, I'm very big on this, that you should never get your athletes injured in the weight room, because they got to go play a sport. And so if you're injuring them in a place that they're getting general physical preparedness, you're really doing the opposite of what we're really trying to do here, is we're trying to prepare the athlete to be able to handle the demands of sport. And when it comes to our older populations, it's the exact same thing, just they're no longer they could be playing sports, but you know, sports are not their driver. Their driver is their everyday life. Getting out of bed, you know, being able to go to the toilet, pull out the chair, maybe crawl up on or step up on a step stool and reach on the top shelf for something, do some gardening outside, pick up the grandkids, right? You know, bring the boxes inside from Amazon that are relatively heavy, do something with the dogs, with the animals. Those are real everyday tasks that happen that as individuals age and they don't do something to take care of their body, they will begin to see a much steeper decline. And so we want to make sure that the exercises that we're giving them are good for them in their current state that they're at. So, you know, we don't have to have Betty Sue doing a back squat on day one. right? We can pick a goblet squat variation and get plenty of progress. And that's going to be a super safe variation. There's nothing bad that's going to happen from doing a goblet squat. So we don't need to be conservative in terms of we just need to actually do a chair or a assisted sit to stand, even though they can certainly do a loaded goblet box squat, for example. Okay, so you got to find the exercise that clearly meets the individual where they're at. But I do think that people are too overly cautious as a whole when it comes to the older population. So now I want to try to get into some of the practical application side. How should we actually program for older adults in a way that will actually maximize the results while managing actual risk that could happen? And so I'm going to break this down by each individual training variable that most training programs are going to address. Number one is going to be starting with the intensity. Okay, older adults should train, again, at those intensities of the 70 to 80, 85% of the max for their overall strength development. That's the percentage range that works to develop strength based upon the research, okay? That's whether you're old or young, does not matter. They still need to work hard at those intensities. And again, just a reminder, I'm not telling you to actually one rep max your older individuals to work in this. You should be able to know that if they are doing hard sets of 6 to 8 with 1 to 2 reps left in the tank, they're going to be in that range they need to be to build some general strength. The research supports this range as optimal for neuromuscular adaptations. However, the key difference from younger populations is the progression timeline, which I kind of talked about earlier, where you might add weight every week with, like, say, a 25-year-old or even a young athlete. You might progress every 2 to 3 weeks with somebody that's 70 years old. The adaptation timeline is slightly slower. The connective tissues need more time to adjust, adapt to the increased loads. And so just using the same weight for 2 or 3 weeks is not necessarily a bad thing, especially early on. You're just going to slowly chip away at those loads over time. So pick the slowest progression model that you possibly can. Sometimes that's adding reps. Sometimes that's adding weight. Sometimes that might be slowing down tempo. You can still use the same load and still get some progress by manipulating some of the other variables in your training. Volume is where we definitely, though, need to be more thoughtful when it comes to older populations. And so while older adults can handle similar intensities in terms of the one rep max, again, to their younger counterparts, the total volume capacity that these people and our older adults can handle is definitely going to be somewhat reduced compared to the younger populations. So a good starting point is 8 to 12 sets per muscle group per week, which aligns with the research from the Journal of Sports Science showing this range is effective for hypertrophy and strength in older populations. So that's 8 to 12 sets per muscle group per week. Now, obviously, if you're working with somebody one day a week, you're not going to do 12 sets of legs, right? You don't want to do that. That's going to be too much volume. We got to remember everything is also dose dependent. So, you know, if they happen to be getting into some kind of general strength training at twice a week, starting off with maybe only 5 or 6 sets total as an introductory base work to get them going. But then the goal should be to build them up into that 8 to 12 sets over the course of the week. And if you divide that out over 2 to 3 sessions, you know, that could be as simple as doing 4 hardworking sets on day 1, 4 hardworking sets on day 2. That's going to get you to 8. If you got 3, you have another 4 hardworking sets. There's your 12. And you can obviously play with your sets and things there, right? But you get an idea that you don't need a buttload of volume for this population, when you really think about how 8 to 12 sets is, as long as there's enough sessions, okay? Now, recovery between the sessions also is something that needs to be longer. So we talked about volume, but the recovery between each training session. So, you know, you may not be able to go Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. You may need to back off the number of sessions, but also making sure there's enough recovery time between each individual session there. And so instead of training the same muscle group twice per week, many adults do better with a once per week frequency muscle group or a split-based routine that can allow for a little bit more recovery time, especially early on. Now, I'm not saying you should have a long leg day, a shoulder day, an arm day, or whatever, but you can have much more emphasis in early on into the training program to allow them time to recover. Or what you do is you take your sessions and you keep your sessions as few as possible. Maybe you start out with one time a week, sticking with a good quality full body training program, and then your next progression model to get them continued results is to try to get them to bump up to twice a week. So rather than just come in on Monday or Tuesday, now they're coming on Monday and Friday. You're going to allow for ample space there for them to be able to recover from the sessions, and you're naturally going to add volume by doing that, by increasing your number of sessions. Now, your exercise selection should prioritize the compound-based movements that have a high, and I'll use the word, I'm not a big fan of it sometimes, high, quote-unquote, functional-based transfer to their lives. So again, for most people and most things, that's going to be your major movement patterns, your squat-based patterns, your hinge-based patterns like a deadlift or a hinge or an RDL, your presses and your rows and your pulling should form the foundation of all these kind of training programs. So the research, again, in the Journal of Aging and Physical Activity demonstrates that these multi-joint exercises produce superior function outcomes compared to isolation-based exercises. However, we do need to consider joint health. So if someone has significant knee arthritis, we might use a trap bar deadlift, right, instead of a deep squat-based position early on. Or we might use a goblet squat instead of our barbell squat. Right. So you're going to use some different tools and implements. And I've always been big on this, is that you adapt the exercise variation to the individual. And depending upon what you need to get out of that individual, you do not have to force feed a conventional deadlift and a barbell back squat and a barbell bench press. You're going to find the exercise selection that's going to work well for them. The principle is always going to be the same. We're going to use compound movements with progressive overload, but we select the variations that work well within this individual's structural limitations, especially if there are injuries or issues or nagging things that they have that we're trying to not only work around, but we're trying to slowly work through and try to slowly get to go away through ideally smart training and exercise selection. Now, the critical principle that I think a lot of trainers miss is that we actually need to include some kind of power training with this population. So remember that the loss of the type 2 muscle fibers and the reduction in the race rate of force development was something we talked about earlier, and this is addressed through explosive movements. And research in the Journal of Gerontology shows that power training, which involves moving moderate loads as quickly as possible, is actually more effective than traditional strength training for improving your quote-unquote functional outcomes like stair climbing and sitting and standing off of a chair. So this could be things like some med ball throws. It could be some very light jump training if appropriate, or to a very low box, or even using maybe a slightly bit of band assistance to be able to help unweight them so they can still actually get into some very light jumping, or just simply performing the concentric portion of some of your strength-based exercises with a maximum or near maximum intended velocity. So a great example of this would be if you have an athlete doing, or an athlete, I'm sorry, excuse me, they could be an athlete, but if you have an older individual doing, say, a kettlebell sumo deadlift off of maybe a block or maybe just off the ground, and if you're, as they're warming up, you can emphasize, hey, we need to try to pull some of these lighter weights as fast as we possibly can, and that can give you the power output that you need, one, in your training program. It can be a great way to warm up and potentiate for this particular population. And you can kill two birds with one stone because you're not going to have to change implements. So you can get that power aspect, and you can also get the general strength aspect out of that particular exercise as well. Again, it's just an example. You can do the same thing with like a goblet squat or a band assisted push-up or a dumbbell bench press, right? You can certainly get very similar results by doing that. So you're going to take kind of a dynamic effort approach almost to your workup sets for some of these populations as a freebie way to jump into this and be able to get them some rate of force development. Now, a practical protocol that you can also use is you can get a quote-unquote speed day and part of their workouts within their weekly training session. And so one day a week, you're just going to take some of those loads that you're already doing, and then you can just stick around 50 to 60%-ish of the one rep max. So for most people, that's going to be if they're doing their goblet squats on a normal training day, you can take about 70-ish percent of those, maybe 80% of what they normally use, and just focus on moving the weights relatively quickly during the concentric portion. And that can address some of your power development as well. If you want to just have a dedicated day, a little bit more towards power development, it could be a quicker workout day to where they come in and they do some of those major movement patterns versus do some things concentrically. And then you can throw in either some conditioning or extra mobility work and call it a day. And it will actually get them in the gym relatively quick. And then you're only focusing on one training adaptation for the most part for that individual day. And you're also going to limit soreness as well, which can be great for this population also. But it's also going to mean that you don't have to worry about teaching grandma and grandpa Olympic lifts. You don't have to worry about doing crazy plyometrics, right? I think it's a much more realistic way to get rid of force development out of this population. But I do think if you have an older individual that you can get to doing some lower box jumps or some very low hurdle or line hop variations or some very, very general body weight plyometrics and they can handle it, I think that's a great idea. I do know that for many of these populations, this is definitely something you have to work into. For sure, you cannot just throw them into plyometrics day one for a lot of them because a lot of them have not ran or jumped or landed from anything in a very long time. So the last thing you want to do is begin aggravating tissues. So again, doing more of a quote-unquote speed or dynamic effort-based work with some of your strength movements is a great way to segue into some of that stuff if they are interested in that. And again, it's the conversation you have to have with that older individual. I also like doing more sled-based work here from a lower body perspective with some of our older populations. Now, the range of motion is also another area where we need to be rather intelligent in terms of our training and our programming with this population. You know, the principle of training through a full range of motion is always going to be sound, ideally the way that you want to go about this. And this is definitely backed by research, so that there's greater muscle growth with a full range of motion in an exercise. However, again, thinking about our population, if someone has actual structural limitations, joint damage, you know, not just overall tightness, then we work within their available ranges and progressively try to expand that over the course of our time of working with them. So the 70-year-old with, you know, bone-on-bone knee arthritis isn't going to squat ass to grass day one, but they can still do a box squat of some variation. And we can progressively try to lower that box height over time. And then we can try to take the box away. We can start implementing maybe some isometrics to be able to strengthen some of those tendons and things, right? There's different ways that you can go about that. But the goal should always be to, again, meet them where they're at, work with the limitations that they have, and then try to open up their training options and availability from their movement perspective. And that will eventually let them be able to get down to doing a squat right around 90 degrees, especially if you start adding like heel wedges and things like that. Now, rest periods are generally going to be similar to your younger counterparts. You know, rest periods are pretty much rest periods, especially from your strength work. 2 to 3 minutes between your sets is going to allow adequate recovery for this population. However, I often find that older adults benefit from slightly longer rest periods, especially if you try to give them some appreciable amount of loads, because their body is going to take time to recover from that. But also, we want to mentally make sure that they are ready for things as well. They are going to be, you know, internally thinking about how heavy something might be. If you hand them a 40 or 50 pound dumbbell, they've worked up to that, that's going to feel relatively heavy to them. We want to make sure that they're mentally prepared as well on some of those intensities. Now, you know, there's not really like a benefit of like rushing through your workouts. You know, the adequate rest serves a purpose and allows them to maintain quality movement and intensity across their sets, which for this population, that intensity piece is important. So we want to make sure that each set can get that intensity, not only from an effort side, but also from a mental side, that they're going to be okay with that. We don't want them to think, oh, that's heavy, I'm only going to do that, I'm done, I don't want to do that anymore, right? We want to make sure they've got adequate rest. We let them know, take your time, we're not in any rush here. This is not a cardio session. We're trying to build general strength, and that requires adequate rest. Now, frequency is where I think we make one of the biggest changes and adjustments when it comes to this population. You know, the younger athlete is definitely going to potentially be able to train 4, 5, 6 days per week, generally recover just fine, and actually wants to be in the gym that frequently, where the older adult do better generally with more from 2 to 4 days per week, depending upon how much experience they have. And it's not because they can't handle the more frequent training, but because the recovery is just overall going to always take longer. And so building in those buffers is what's going to be important. And so The research in the International Journal of Sports Medicine shows that protein synthesis rates and hormonal recovery follow a slower timeline in older adults. So the additional rest days and recovery days are going to support that adaptation rather than actually hinder it. And one more critical thing here before we move on to the next section is that we need to include specific training for rate of force development and that reactive strength that I've kind of talked about. So you need to make sure that that's touched upon. And this could be, again, simple as practicing very quickly, sit to stand from very basic older populations as they get going, trying to sit up as fast as they possibly can early on, and then actually doing some step ups with some intent to get some, maybe some single leg power, or being able to step up the steps relatively quickly if they happen to have stairs in their home, or even again, some low level plyometrics and box jumps that we've kind of talked about. So, you know, you want to make sure that the exercises here that you're picking fit the individual. But the nice thing about some of this rate of force development stuff is that people that had better rate of force development in these populations showed improved fall recovery ability, which is arguably more important than preventing the falls in the first place. So I don't want to say that we know they're going to fall. Obviously, the goal is to prevent them falling. But I do feel that when it comes to older populations, having a fall is probably inevitable at some point. So if they can recover from that, being able to get back up quicker, being able to recover from the fall, they're not in the bed for a week because their back hurts, right? Their ability to also just recover from the initial trauma they had because their bones are stronger, their muscles are more developed, their overall recovery systems and their body are better because they've been active. Those are all great things when it comes to the falling and falling prevention. Now, for this fourth aspect that I wanted to discuss is going to be more on the pathologies and the workarounds for these populations. And the reality of training older adults is that many of them are going to come to us with pre-existing conditions, previous injury history, structural changes that we're going to have to work around. That's just, it's probably going to happen more cases than not when you get to be working with older individuals or you begin to work with some of them. But working around something doesn't mean that we have to avoid training that area entirely. And it just means being intelligent about exercise selection and the progression. And to tell you a quick story about this is that I've got an awesome client. I've worked with her for, I think, pretty close to a decade at this point. It's been a very long time. And she has worked off and on with PTs for several issues. And it seems that the one thing that has been consistently good for her is doing her strength training with me, initially me, and now with Thirst, so me and Adrian. And I've always taken control of her programming from that side, but I always also try to, you know, work around what the PTs have been telling her. And the biggest knock that I always have on them is when they say, don't do X exercise. And that's very, very frustrating. And usually you're going to see the common ones, don't squat, don't deadlift, don't lunge, right? Those are usually the big three that physical therapists, and I got my after going on physical therapists here, but the big ones that we typically tend to hear to avoid are those kind of exercises, especially in the older populations. Again, it's not that we want to avoid these exercises. Again, some PTs have no idea when you see a squat, they're thinking about a barbell, right? Or they're thinking about a bench press, or they're thinking about them doing just traditional walking lunges, right? There's several ways that we can train those patterns and work around that. And we shouldn't necessarily stop, quote unquote, squatting or stop, quote unquote, lunging, right? We can do different split squat variations. We can do different step up variations. Okay. We can do different squatting variations and different pushing variations that can allow us to still train the exact same movement pattern, but in a much better and more efficient way that's going to be applicable towards that individual, to where it's not only going to not cause pain, but hopefully it's going to help remedy the pain that they're having and get them to actually feeling better. So really, really be careful. You got to make sure, you know, you walk a fine line if you're working with these individuals, because they're going to say, oh, well, my physical therapist said I can't do that exercise, so we're not going to squat today. I'm going to skip that one. No, we need to figure out which exercise is right for you and then build upon that works within the constraints that we can while we also try to aid what the physical therapist is saying. All right. So one of the things that's incredibly common with this population is osteoarthritis, particularly in like their knees, their hips, and even in their back. And the traditional point, you know, the traditional approach again for something like this is just avoid loading the affected joint or area. And the research tells us this is actually asked backwards. So a comprehensive review in osteoarthritis and cartilage found that resistance training not only doesn't worsen arthritis, but actually helps reduce pain and improves function. The key is selecting exercises that load the joint within a tolerable range and progressively building the work capacity. So for knee arthritis, this might mean starting with partial range squats or high box squats, maybe even a leg press if you need to. And instead of obviously going again with a nice big deep barbell back squat and then progressively increasing range of motion as their tolerance improves. And the worst thing that we can do is, in my opinion, is loading the movement entirely, which then obviously is going to lead to muscle atrophy and then further joint instability down the long haul. So loading where we can and making the modifications again, not to sound like a broken record here, is going to be the key thing, especially when it comes to osteoarthritis. Now, osteoporosis is another common concern when it comes to older populations. And this one actually makes the case for heavy resistance training even stronger, because if you know anything about osteoporosis, you know that building bone density comes from loading structure, which is going to come from using weights. Research in the Journal of Bone and Mineral Research demonstrates that high intensity resistance training is one of the most effective interventions for improving bone density in postmenopausal women. However, we need to be cautious when spinal flexion underneath load, particularly individuals with severe osteoporosis or previous compression-based fractures, in their back. This means modifying certain exercises like your deadlifts or choosing variations that minimize spinal flexion, such as trap bar deadlifts or rack pulls, right? So working within the range of motions that you have, picking smart exercises, but understanding that those with osteoporosis, especially from a spine perspective, can have a little bit of increased risk. So just making smart exercise choices. But the big thing when it comes to osteoporosis is that, especially for the women's side, is that heavy loaded strength training is what's going to help either reverse this or help prevent it. It's not going to be the very high reps with the pink dumbbells. That's not going to cut it. Now, rotator cuff issues are, you know, another extremely common exercise or pathology that we see in older adults. And so the standard approach is usually the endless band work that you're going to see with the light isolation exercises. And those usually fail because it doesn't actually address the problem, which is these individuals lack the strength to stabilize and hold their shoulder in the proper positions under load. Okay. I'm not knocking ER-based work with your hands and some of the IR work. For some populations that have done absolutely nothing with these older adults, that's going to be their introductory and first step. But most people are going to graduate from the banded ER and IR-based work. Now we got to actually, again, focus on loading the structure. So research in the Journal of Orthopedic and Sport Physical Therapy shows that progressive resistance training of the rotator cuff and surrounding musculature is more effective than the traditional physical therapy exercises that are generally prescribed. The key is starting with, again, appropriate loads and ranges of motion, and then progressively increasing the demands as the older person or your client begins to see progress. Now, this might mean starting, obviously, with hands elevated based push-ups, right? You know, going very, very easy, or band-assisted based push-ups, and then progressing over the months to ideally getting them on the floor and doing them on their knees, or maybe actually getting some quality push-ups in, and then to some other dumbbell pressing movements. You can also implement the dumbbell pressing movements. I'm not saying you have to make them do a bodyweight push-up before you go to dumbbells. I think people that do that are very stuck in one ways. The dumbbell pressing can certainly help, but I think having a place to start when it comes to your push-ups and making sure they can do push-ups properly, because again, if we kind of think about if they fall on the floor, we want to be able to make sure they can push themselves up off of things, ideally in certain ways. I think there's lots of great benefits to push-ups. I'm very, very pro push-up, but I also am a realist and know that for some people, especially older women, using dumbbells is a great way to build strength to be able to aid to build that push-up. So all great things there, but when it comes to your dumbbell pressing, especially if there's rotator cuff issues, going with neutral grip options or limiting range of motion early, maybe even doing a floor press can be a great place to start. And then as that rotator cuff strengthens with some of the other exercises that you're doing, some of your face pulls and your pull aparts, you know, some of your upper back work in terms of your rowing or maybe your pull downs, as all the muscles around the shoulder get stronger, help stabilize that shoulder better, because really it's probably not just the rotator cuff. All the bigger muscles around the shoulder joint need to be strong too. And that's probably what they're really truly missing out on. Once you do that, then you can begin to progress to some of the other harder pressing exercises as long as they can tolerate it. The cardiovascular concerns require a more measured approach, I think is probably the better way to split it. Now, if someone has a documented heart disease or a significant risk factor, they need medical clearance before beginning their strength training program. So this is why I'm also very pro assessment consultation. You can get to this very, very quickly and know if you're going to need a doctor's note or the proper clearance to work with these people. And again, as we talk about some of these older populations, those that have had like stents or some kind of like heart issue is going to be much higher than when you're working with the younger population. So it's going to be more prevalent for sure. But the research in the American Journal of Cardiology shows that resistance training, when properly prescribed, is safe and beneficial for individuals with cardiovascular disease. The key modifications are obviously going to be avoiding maximal effort singles, like, you know, doing a big squat single or bench single, you know, using controlled breathing to avoid more of the Valsalva maneuver during their training, and then monitoring, you know, their general response to training. And many older adults can safely train at higher intensities using their submaximal loads, which still provides excellent strength stimulus without all the cardiovascular stress of the maximal attempts that you normally see in like max effort training or the much heavier strength training that you might do with some of your younger populations. And I would even argue that more than likely, if the person that you're working with has some kind of cardiovascular issue, their GPP is going to be incredibly low. So their physical preparation, their work capacity is incredibly low. Just doing some general strength training, not even in a circuit, just a couple supersets of very basic exercises, like again, like a goblet squat and a chest supported dumbbell row, maybe a landmine press, right? Maybe a dumbbell RDL or some weighted glute bridges. And you do those for a couple rounds for somebody that's just coming to you that has cardiovascular disease, that's going to probably provide a cardiovascular based effect and actually be good for them. And their heart rate's probably going to be up pretty high. So while you're ideally, you're trying to get some strength training, when you're super detrained, almost everything becomes cardiovascular at some point because you just do not have the work capacity to be able to do the work because you've not been doing the work. Something to also consider with this population. Now, the balance side of this does need to be addressed for these individuals, but again, not the way that most people think of. And going back to that unstable surface stuff that we're talking about, it does not transfer to the real world when it comes to balance. So what does work is building, again, the lower body strength, practicing challenging positions with adequate support, and progressively reducing that support as needed. So a good example here is have your client practice like a hand-supported single leg RDL or a split squat, and they can do that by holding either a TRX or a rack, right, to be able to get that support and then progressively try to load that up. And then once they can do that and they've been able to build some tissue, build some strength there, with that general movement pattern, then you progressively try to reduce how much weight they're actually holding on to something, or you slowly remove that again, or you begin to take away some of the points of contact. So from a single leg perspective, they might start off with like a hand-supported kickstand RDL, and that's going to give them plenty of support, right? And then maybe we just go to the regular kickstand RDL, so we're going to take that support away, but both feet are still on the ground. Then maybe we move to a hand-supported single-leg RDL to where we're actually going to truly get on one leg, but we've still got our hand there for support. And then we can actually move to just a regular bilateral loaded single-leg RDL, and fingers are crossed that by then they've built enough general strength and stability with our progression model that they should be able to do just a single-leg RDL with some very, very light weights starting off, just to make sure that they do have the appropriate balance needed to be able to do that. And then you just load as needed. So it's going to obviously build the single leg strength and balance that they need while managing the risk. And that's what you do with your single leg patterns. I think that's going to be the best way to focus on improving their balance, is get them in single leg patterns, not unstable surfaces. Now, the last critical thing here to talk about is going to be the pain side of things, and it is going to be a valuable feedback loop for this population. Now, it should not necessarily be a sign that they need to stop. It could be, but they just need to be aware of the pain that they're feeling and be able to communicate, and then you're going to make some decisions based upon the intensity levels and things like that. So many of the older adults have often been told to avoid activity that's causing discomfort, which then leads to avoidance of overall just movement in general, especially beneficial movement like strength training. So we need to educate clients and older individuals the difference between muscle soreness and joint pain, because those are two different things, and between challenging discomfort in an exercise, because it's just hard, and the actual harmful pain that there's actual some structural damage potentially occurring because of the exercise that we're doing. So a general principle, for me at least, is going to be that if pain increases during the set or persists after the training, that's a sign that we probably need to modify. But if there's mild discomfort that doesn't worsen during the set and resolves with an hour or so after the training, or you know, maybe even just a couple hours after the training, that's typically pretty acceptable when it comes to training. So make sure you understand and you can communicate what that difference is with these individuals. This is going to require, obviously, ongoing communication on both parties here. But I do think what's great about it is it helps this population be a little bit more aware and in tune with their body. Because, again, the stigma is you're old, your body's going to hurt. Well, does your body hurt because you're not moving, or is your body hurt because you're moving wrong or we're doing something that needs to be adjusted? And I'm sure you've all seen kind of like the Spider-Man meme of the Spider-Man guy pointing at himself saying, you know, you hurt because you don't move, you move because you lift too much, or something like that. You know, something along that framework is that's like a big circle. For most people of this age, they're probably more achy because they're not doing anything and they're being sedentary. The physical activity is probably more than likely going to actually make them feel better. Okay. The fifth part here that we're going to talk about, which is a little bit more different, more on the personal trainer side for sure, not so much on the educating of how to train older individuals, is going to be the business and the communication side of this. And the aspects of training older adults is that most certifications don't even really talk about this population. Your education is not really quite there. It kind of comes through firsthand experience initially and just doing some research and really, to me, kind of having a brain and just being smart about how you just train people in general. But the business side and the interpersonal dynamics that you can have with this population can make or break your success with this population. And so number one is understanding that older adults are often your most profitable client demographic. Okay. They have disposable income more than likely, and they're likely to cancel sessions less because they actually value the expertise and are willing to pay for it. You know, they are going to come from a population or an era where they seek information from people that actually knew what they're talking about. They're not used, or I should say, they probably are now, but they didn't grow up with the Google machine and ChatGPT. They actually had to find an expert or go read a book about said topic written by an expert. So they're going to trust experts more so. So therefore, they're going to be willing to pay for it. And they're also going to be willing to stay for you with you for years rather than just months, like your athletic performance people where they're going to have sports. They're going to know that this is an investment long-term. And capturing this market can definitely require a bit of a different approach than training the younger populations who just want to like look good, improve their performance. So from a marketing side to this population, we really need to emphasize the actual quote unquote, again, functional outcomes here, not the aesthetics. Okay. Does grandma or grandpa maybe want to lose some pounds, and would losing some weight potentially help them? Yeah, I would say that it very well could for most people. Especially if they are overweight. But we also want to think that the way that they move and they feel is really what we're trying to sell, not the way that they're looking with their shirts off. So we know that they want to do things like play with their grandchildren and get out of pain. They want to travel without limitations, maybe not having to take a walker on the plane, right? They want to be able to maintain their own independence and to avoid becoming a burden to their families and their loved ones. You know, these are very, very powerful motivating based things when you really think about it. Like, that's a really damn good why to do strength training. Play with your grandchildren, not need a wheelchair, not need a walker, be able to travel and enjoy life, go see stuff, not be a burden, just be able to get up out of bed and go do something versus having to wait for somebody to come help you. That's very, very, very good why of why you can sell and how you can help market this from these populations. You know, now the research, again, in the Journal of Aging Studies shows that functional independence is going to be the primary driver of training adherence in older adults, not the appearance-based goals. So again, sell the adherence in terms of being able to have independence. Don't worry about trying to sell how they're going to look or building, you know, delts and chests and glutes. That's not going to sell for this population. Now, the communication side also has to adjust here a little bit. Many older adults come from a generation that respects authority and expertise, like I kind of talked about, but they also need to understand the why behind your prescribing something. These people, I don't want to sound bad saying that, older individuals, they like to know why they're doing something. They're actually just genuinely curious, where the younger population, they don't seem to give a shit, right? They care about getting better, faster, stronger, whatever. And if they want to know why, they're going to go to Google or ChatGPT and just type it in and find out. Or they're going to ask their favorite fitness influencer, or they're going to look on YouTube, right? They're just going to outsource it to some kind of technology to be able to find it. But the older population is not like that. They, again, they want to go directly to the source and then find out why they are doing that. So I personally have a lot of respect for that. I really, again, I'm not old, but I think maybe I'm probably kind of like the cutoff of people that would like to talk to the real people. You know, I traveled and learned things in my powerlifting days and actually went and trained with people and went directly to the source to learn. And again, that was kind of before social media really popped off of just being able to send a DM to somebody. So, you know, I think that's why they are like this. They have just not been reliant on that as a way to get their education or their information. And so therefore they're going to come to you as a trainer, or they're going to want you to be able to explain why they're doing said exercise, especially when the stigma is going to be that they shouldn't be doing strength training. So keep that in mind. So don't be afraid to take the time to explain the reason and why high intensity based strength training is good for them. And maybe use some research to support the recommendation. Be able to say, hey, I'm going to look this up and provide it for you. Or, you know, addressing their concerns directly will build their trust faster than any kind of like certification really ever could, or any kind of educational based thing that you're going to go after. Being able to just support your information that you're giving them, and for those people, that's usually going to go a long way. Now, from a business reality side here, is that you have to be able to manage expectations around progression timelines for these people. So the older populations and adults are, as we mentioned, are going to adapt slower than your younger clientele. And if they're comparing themselves to that younger population or some of the younger people in your gym that they happen to be working around or near, or maybe even with, they could be expecting these rapid changes and improvement. They could potentially get discouraged. So you want to let them know early on and try to set a realistic timeline from the beginning that, hey, we can make progress. This may take a little bit more time, but you just got to trust me that if you're putting in the work, you're putting in the effort, you're doing the things outside of the gym, still getting enough sleep, still eating well, it's going to happen. And so I like to kind of tell my older clients that we're looking at usually like a 12 to 16 week timeline to really see notable, significant strength progress and improvement, compared to maybe 8 to 12 weeks for like your younger individuals or your athletes, right? So it's not that that's a, you know, a crazy time frame. To me, when I think about training, I think if I'm going to see progress in 3 to 4 months, I personally think that is super quick. But again, I've been around training a long time, and I know training myself, and I know how long it can take me to just do something on my squat and bench press for my powerlifting years, right? Sometimes putting 5 to 10 pounds on in a year is a major uphill battle. And so when I think about seeing some 3 to 4 months, it's like, man, that would be freaking awesome. So just make sure that they understand that it could be a little bit more of a slow grind, especially if they've got some things that you're having to work around, and you're having to maybe even consult with a physical therapist that they're seeing as well, and you're kind of tag teaming things here. So it's not that we're lowering the standards for these people. It's just being honest about what the adaptation rates are for this particular area and subset group of people. Now, I know many people also get a little worried about like the liability side, but really the liability stuff shouldn't like make you go into paralysis of analysis into prescribing ineffective programming and whatever. So these are just regular people like you and me. Okay. They're just going to need some tweaking along the way. And in my experience, the older population that I work with have been some of the coolest freaking people. They have so much life experience. They have so much words of wisdom as you get to know them. And they are, especially if they're retired, you know, they're super chill. Their stress is relatively low. Like, they are just super easy pleasing people, more cases than not. I think they're some of the most fun people to train from that interaction standpoint. Yes, the programming is not sexy, but the interaction with that person makes the training sessions feel much better and much more enjoyable, if I'm being honest. Because let's be frank, athletes and younger people, they can be short with you sometimes. They can have some tunes. Not that older people can't, but you know, if a kid has a bad day at school, they can just be shitty all day and not want to work hard. And that's not as common when it comes to the older population. Now, from a liability side here, before I got off tangent, is that, you know, just make sure you've got your normal documentation, your liability waivers. If they need clearance, you have that in writing or an email that you can print off, right? You've got something to back you up that you've done your due diligence of outsourcing, whether they can do some stuff. You know, the intake forms of like their medications and pre-existing conditions and medical clearances, right? And taking notes on what they can and can't do or what they work well from in the past. Like, that's all going to be something that can potentially protect you if something goes wrong from a legal perspective. It's still going to let you be able to program the proper training that you want to. Now, I've never had anything from a legal perspective ever happen to me on this front, and I really hope I obviously never do. But again, I always am, if I'm ever in doubt, just refer out and just cover your butt early on. It would be worth it, obviously, if something would happen. Now, on the business side, mistakes that I kind of have seen in the past is that there's trainers that are going to be working with older adults, and they like to position themselves as like the senior fitness specialist or the I work with old people. Old people are kind of like my shtick, and only attracting that demographic. I think doing that with any kind of population is going to pigeonhole you from a professional standpoint. You know, you want to position yourself as a strength and conditioning expert, period, point blank. Age should not matter. You should want to be able to work with a variety of populations, and having a lot of expertise in different populations, and that aging populations is a subset you can work with and that you can get improvement with, not just the 18-year-olds. Okay. So it's also going to allow you to have obviously the diverse clientele side from a business perspective if you are a personal trainer, for those of you that are listening in that group. Now, I do think, again, going to my business, I still always think that semi-private or small group training is definitely the most effective way to go about this. But I think with older adults, I think you could also really upsell some stuff if you have just an older adult group that you work with. Because if you think about it, again, if they're retired, they do a lot of stuff together, right? They go do, they might go out to the gaming stuff that they do in terms of like the bingo and the book clubs and maybe the casino. They go to the Sunday brunch or the church crowd with that group, right? They hang out together a lot and do a lot of stuff because one, they have the time and they want social interaction. And you got to think about it, for a lot of them, if they've had kids and or grandkids, they're not around during the school day and whatever. Like, most people are at work doing stuff. So I don't want to say they're lonely, but they're just looking for general social engagement, just like you and I would when we want to go do something. So making a group training class for an older individual-based group, I think, is a great from a business model perspective and a way to get in and tap into that option as well. Now, research in the psychology of sport and exercise shows that group training environments improve adherence and motivation in older populations. However, the programming needs need to allow for individual modification. So that's where you got to be really, really good at being able to pivot on a dime when it comes to working with, say, 6 to 8 people that are 65, 70, 75 years old. So, you know, you're going to have different weights available, different progression and regressions right off the get-go. Got to know them off of your head. Not necessarily using any kind of percentage-based training program. Not really big on anyways, but especially with this population, just being able to teach them to go by feel and how weights feel, and then structuring them so that everybody's able to allow to work at their own individual intensity with a group setting. It's not a keeping up with each other. You don't want somebody literally having to use their life alert because you're trying to push them to keep up with some of the other people. Now, here's one of the things that I think most people that have worked with older individuals, they don't consider, and that they have a lot of time flexibility that the younger clients do not, which means you can offer some of your downtime, especially on a one-on-one training perspective. You can offer some of those mid-morning or early afternoon sessions that usually you never fill, or you just use as downtime for billing or whatever. I know for my gym, like, we're just closed. We're closed from 9 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But like, what the hell do you do during that time? Well, I do travel and do some offsite training. My wife does work with some people one-on-one during that time. You know, I'm also trying to get me some more people during that time. I do the billing. I do some social media stuff. I do some marketing stuff, right? There's things that I do from a business owner during that time. But again, majority of my populations that I'm working with are at school or at work. Well, this population does not have to worry about that. So if you're looking at a way to make some side cash or fill in some downtime, this is a great population to attempt to get into, because they are going to be more than likely, that's going to be a quote unquote great time for them. So it's going to let you be able to potentially create some additional revenue opportunities that you normally wouldn't have. So don't knock the old guys, because also the fact is they will pay for it, right? They're probably not going to bat an eye at what you're charging. Now, the last business consideration here is understanding the referral potential side of things. You know, the older adults we talked about, like the social structures that they have, they can get great results from a referral side, because one, they get incredibly loyal to stuff, right? They get set in their ways, and they find something they absolutely like, they rant and rave about it to anybody that will listen to them talk about it. And because they're loyal, they're also continue to come back. So, you know, you can have a nice long relationship with them. From a business side, they can be somebody that's invested into your business for a very long time without even having to really think about it. And they're going to tell their friends, they're going to tell their doctors, they're going to tell their family members that they're going to the gym and working with John, and John's helped them be able to get up off the toilet much easier, or get out of bed much easier during the day, or now they're outside walking the dog, like all those little things. But to them, that's incredibly important, and they're going to tell anybody that will listen to them about it. So, you know, one really satisfied 65 to 75 year old client can refer 3 to 5 more clients to you pretty quickly, especially if you get a really good relationship with them after a couple months and you're not afraid to ask them for a referral, or ask them if they have any friends or if they'd like to work out with somebody, maybe even explain if you're doing one-on-one, if they bring somebody, how it's going to drop the rate they charge. They're both going to pay less and you're going to make more, and it's a win-win for everybody, right? So there's a lot of really, really good business opportunities here from working with those populations. Now, again, my gym's semi-private, so my older personal training clients paying the same amount that my youth athletes paying in terms of their sessions, their monthly commitments or their 4-week commitments, whatever. But, you know, they can still refer people and they can sign up together if they really wanted to, which is absolutely great. But this only happens, obviously, if you're getting the results, which brings me kind of back full circle of the whole entire episode, is that you got to prescribe and give these people challenging programming based on, one, some of the research that I've talked about, but just general quality, fundamental training, and not doing stupid shit and doing stuff that's going to be cautious, or having them stand on BOSU balls, or just doing band exercises, right? Actually doing some legitimate training is what these people need. So to wrap this up with a pretty bow, let's kind of tie all together with some action steps that, you know, we can do from an older individual side. If you happen to be training people, or you're just looking to get some education when it comes to training older individuals, step number one is going to be looking at what your current programming is for older adults if you already work with older adults. Are you actually giving them the intensity and the effort that they need in their exercises? I'm not saying you're riding their ass, but you're actually making the training challenging for them. Are you doing that? Are you doing a little bit of power and velocity-based work? And if you're not, you're potentially leaving some results on the table. Start figuring out how you can implement some of this rate of force development work with some of your older populations and being able to progressively get their programs shifted towards that, and then explaining to them why you're kind of making some adaptation or some changes here and the adaptations that will come from those changes. All right, number two that we need to do here is we need to just get rid of, obviously, any of the stupid arbitrary exercises that don't have any research and support. I really hope if you're here listening to the Thirst More podcast and you know me and in any kind of meaningful way, and you've been around any of my content, you know my hate and disdain for some of the stupid shit that goes on in the fitness industry. So I really hope that you are somebody that's not using a BOSU ball or any of those ridiculous stability exercises. But if you are, I'm not judging you. Get rid of it. Move on with your life and just start programming some really good quality single leg work, and you will see way more progress and you're going to look like a rock star to this population. And then remove the ridiculous amount of just band exercises that we're doing with the ERIR and all that kind of stuff. You know, don't bother and waste your time with that. Again, just focus on your quality compound strength movements. All right, step number three is going to be educate your clients as you begin to work with these people. Explain to them why you're doing what you're doing. I think it's going to get more buy-in in the long run. You can show them studies if you absolutely want to. Some people are into that. Some of the older adults certainly will. They may even read it. You can shoot them an email or shoot them a text message with it, whatever. However they choose to get it, doesn't really matter. But you want to challenge their preconceptions about what's actually possible and why this stuff actually works. And then that, again, this education process that you're giving them, especially if they are a ask why type person, it's going to help you build buy-in and increase them continue to show up to the training week in and week out. Step number four, once you've kind of done that and you feel comfortable working with them here, start implementing some of that power training into your training programs. And again, like I said, it doesn't need to be complex. Start with the most basic stuff you can think about. Some very light med ball work, doing some really light, simple, quote unquote, speed work with sub-maximal loads on exercises they're very comfortable with and already proficient with, or even just cueing that they try to stand up a little bit more explosively when they're doing their squats, right? Try to get some intent out of some things. Step number five, just expect that you're going to have, again, a little bit longer progression time, especially if you get some new people. Make sure you're honest and upfront with that early. I think that's the big thing here that you can do, is as you acquire older populations that you work with, you're just honest and upfront about the progression timelines. And they're probably going to ask, you know, when can I begin to see some progress? And as they have small wins, celebrate those small wins. If they're getting up off the ground easier, they're not walking with their cane anymore. You know, they hit 20 pounds on their goblet squat. Like, celebrate those small things, because to them, that's going to be huge. And it may not be huge to you, but if you've ever worked with populations that have made some of these like miraculous comebacks, maybe miraculous is a big word, but they've made some pretty life-changing improvements. You gotta celebrate those. You gotta celebrate those, especially with these populations. It will go a very long way and will probably get you another client or two if you do it really well. So here's the primary message, take home day, that I want you to get from my episode here on the Thirst for More podcast, is that older adults, they're not fragile. They are capable of significant strength gains, muscle growth and mass, improving some performance improvements, even though the performance improvements are going to look much different to someone like you and I. They can still see performance gains when giving the proper training stimulus. So the research is overwhelmingly supportive of high intensity resistance strength training as the most effective intervention for maintaining not only their function, but their independence, their quality of life as they begin to age through the years. So our role as coaches is to not protect them from challenge, but to be able to provide the right amount of challenge with intelligent progressions. And then when we get the shift from the quote unquote senior fitness crowd and the silver sneakers bullshit to actually some hard quality strength training, good quality strength training that the evidence clearly supports in the research, You'll begin to see much better results with them, and hopefully you can acquire some of these people as well if you are a trainer and it helps you from a business perspective. I'm always very pro do what you got to do, but I don't, you know, don't sell yourself out. But if you are educating this stuff, I think this is a niche. If you're not tapping into it, can hopefully drive up some revenue for you and can help you dominate your market over the next months, if not years. Now, as always, if you happen to find this episode valuable, do me a favor, share it with a colleague, somebody you know. Maybe you know an older individual that listens to podcasts that's not into strength training. Maybe you can nudge that over to them. I'd really appreciate that and pass on that message on. And no matter where you're listening, Apple, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you enjoy your podcast, if you can, do me a favor, leave a review, 5-star. If you can actually leave a physical review, that's even better. I really, really appreciate that. That always helps me out and helps the channel out. And I will have show notes here for some things you can reference in terms of the research articles that I use to quote, because I know I quoted a lot of them here. I'll have those linked in the show notes for you that you can find in the description box below or in the show notes side of however you happen to be choosing to enjoy this episode. So until next time, keep challenging some of the traditional wisdom about old people and their fitness. We got to be able to do a little bit better, especially if you're like me. My parents are beginning to come these ages, and I want the best what's for my parents and really overall just every older individual. And I don't want to see people going to silver sneakers. I'd like to see the older population get into an actual quality strength and conditioning based program or personal training program, make some real progress, really extend the quality of their life, and really enjoy those last 10, 15, 20, 25 years that they can with people like not only you and me, but their grandchildren, children, friends, family, what have you. So again, thanks for tuning in. I really appreciate it. I'll see you at the next episode. Thanks for listening to Thirst for More podcast. Make sure you give us a follow on Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere else you like to consume your podcast. You can also check us out on YouTube at The Smitley, where you'll find clips and lots of educational-based material for strength and conditioning and exercise science. You can also make sure you give me a follow on Instagram at The Smitley or at Team Thirst, which is my gym Instagram page. For any more future updates on episodes to come, you can make sure you follow me there. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you at the next episode.